tried to find out information, because imagine I get that feeling like I've come true. And when I got to my first writers of foster homes, you got, and they used to like to, my anger is I was relocated. Me. I'm sober. And then 130s. Was told all these position, if she doesn't follow through, what this, you know, the application, and they, you know, because I'm a junkyard dog. Alcoholics Anonymous. Believe that I, being the alcoholic that I am, I went, can you believe that? I mean, you wouldn't believe the things that I get exposed to, but, it, and of course, they helped me a lot with all of that. As you well can tell. Well, I'm going to tell you this one story, and then I'm going to close. There was this a possibility of it was called a development position. They're creating a new department. And I thought, you know, I'd like to apply for that job. But I thought, you know, it's really way out of anything that I could ever do. But I thought, well, you know what? I'm just going to go ahead and try. I'm just going to try. Why not? I love practice in life. If anything Alcoholics Anonymous and the Steps have taught me is we get to practice life here. You know, in AA and in the meetings and when we get to share and when we get to be in fellowship, this is where we dive for those balls. Yeah? You know, you see that ball coming, it's like, are you going to go for it and just kind of put your mitt out there, or are you going to dive for that baby, right? And what I've learned to do in Alcoholics Anonymous is I've learned to dive for those balls. I did. That's it. That's what I do. Because I like to live my, I'm very self-expressed and passionate about life. So I went to this interview and I walked in. It was one at the MU. It was in this big conference room with, you know, in a fancy conference. It was in the me room. And this room is, the room itself is intimidating because it's so large. And it's got a real beautiful wood table. And it's a kind where you can see the reflection of people's suits in the table. And there were like 12 or 13 people on this committee. And they asked me a lot of really hard questions. A lot of really hard questions. And I did the best I could to answer them. In the end, the last question they asked me was, you know, if you're the successful candidate in this position, you'll be interacting with a lot of highly educated people. And we want to know, you know, what is it that you do in your community that is a contribution back to the community that you live in? Now, you know, I thought to myself, well, self. You can't tell them that you're an alcoholic, right? You can't tell them that because they'll think, you know, what will they think of you? And then that other part of me said, you know, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't even be here. So I looked at him and said, I have a little bit of resistance in sharing with you what I do in my community, but I want you to know that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very involved in service work. And I told them about the H&I work that I've done over the years and the things that I've been involved in. And I said, you know, and I realize that based on this, it might be detrimental about the possibility of me getting this job. But I want to really thank you for the opportunity to be here. Because from where I came from, this is nothing short of a miracle. So I want to thank you. And I left. And I never thought that I was going to get that job. And do you know what? I got that job. And today I'm a superintendent in facilities at UC Davis. And that is, you know where my last drunk was? My last drunk on July the 11th was in the medical center on Stockton Boulevard. They had me strapped to a gurney, right? They had me strapped to a gurney, had IVs in my arms and hoses up my nose, and I was flopping around like a Deb car, right? So when they say what's possible in AA, anything's possible because we've been given the keys to the kingdom. And they say that if you're willing to do, that great things will come to pass if you're willing to do the deal. And I've been willing to do the deal, and great things have come to pass in my life. I'm going to tell you a story about an Indian, and then I'm going to sit down. I went to the Las Vegas conference for American Indians about 8 years or 9 years ago. And instead of having marathon meetings, they have talking circles. And in a talking circle, you stay for the whole completion of the circle and the communication. And there was a man that was leading that was 15 years sober and 90 years old.
Ooh.
Check that out. He's 15 years sober and 90 years old. And he was a medicine man. And he says, you know, as young people, it's very important that you go to faraway places. He says, you know, as a young child, I used to live on a reservation, and the medicine man always carried rocks. And I knew that the rocks that the medicine man carried were spiritual healing rocks. I knew that. But I couldn't speak to the medicine man until my head was at top of his shoulder. And he said, when that day come, I went to him because I wanted to be able to get these powerful healing rocks. He said, so I went to him, and I asked him, medicine man, you know, where do we get, what are these rocks and where do you get them? And he said that the medicine man put his arm around his shoulder and he said, well, son, I'm just moving that rock, I'm just moving that mountain one rock at a time. He says what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous as American Indians is it says in the first step that we get to do this thing together. And on some days, you know, my rocks, I can't carry them by myself. So you get to help me. And over a period of time, it doesn't matter how big your mountain of rocks is. The remorse, the problems with your family, the dreams that you never fulfilled on, the things that you never did because you just it got to be a place where it's too overwhelming. In Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a place where you get to come, and every day you can move a rock. And when you're tired, somebody else helps you move that rock. And I thought that was a beautiful story. And then he said, you know, the other thing is, young people, you love to go to faraway places. My nieces and nephews and always want to go to Hawaii and Jamaica and Mexico. He says, it's good to go to faraway places. He says, and I ask of you that when you go there that you get the soil. And you take the soil and you hold it and you feel the texture of the soil and you smell the soil and know the vegetation. It's important to know Mother Earth and all the different things that Mother Earth provides. He says, but I want you to know that the longest journey that you'll ever take will be from your mind to your heart. And that's the journey that we get to take in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to thank you. It's been an honor and a privilege to be with you. I can't tell you what a wonderful day it's been for me. Thank you.
Happens all the time. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 30th, 1981. I am an active member of the Living Life One Day at a Time group in Duluth, Georgia. And my sponsor is Maggie H. And for those statements, those are the most important, most truthful statements I can make about myself today, and they remind me of who and what I am, and because of what they've enabled me to do, whose I am. So anything else I tell you today is going to be the best that I can do under the circumstances of where I am right now. I am so grateful to be here. I'm always grateful to participate. It's an honor and a privilege to participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be standing up here, to be alive, to not be locked up or covered up. And that's where I know without question I would be had it not been for Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come here. It's amazing. My sponsor, there was a gentleman who is dead now from Atlanta named John Flannister, who once said that when you pray the 11th step, you think you're being humble. But in actuality, you're asking for the whole world because you don't know where God's going to take you or where he's going to lead you. And I've had the privilege of being able to go all over this country and to speak why I do not know except to know that I am healed every time I come away from one of these gatherings, because to me this is just God, your God in this room. But I'm grateful to the committee for asking me, for Allison, Butch, everybody who, Bob, it's good to see Bob. I've got friends here from Atlanta, Kim and Sean, and I saw Harold and Jenny. It was a privilege. And I'm traveling with my husband. God knows where that man is. I haven't seen him since I got here. And I want to make an announcement right now that not for him not to leave this room before I see him this morning, because I got a feeling I'm not going to see him for the rest of the day. But that's a privilege, too, because he and I just celebrated 14 years of marriage in this program. And next week he'll have 20 years sobriety. And we met when we were 4 and 6 years sober, so, and now we're 18 and 20. You might say we're in our teenage years, and we're kind of in a rebellious stage, too. He retired a couple of years ago, and I said I'm going to have him put to sleep if he didn't get something to do, but I am very, very grateful for him. I met him as an alcoholic, and what he did for me in the beginning as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I will always be grateful for. And no matter what happens to us, I will always remember the things that he taught me through this program. Let's see, I'm very nervous. I'm always nervous. That's nothing new for me. I'm just one of these who's just about to come apart any minute. And I stay that way most of the time, but you can well imagine what I was like when I was drinking. But I am here to tell you what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. And a lot of times lately, I've got some notes up here because I get a little bit lost. I had some surgery recently, and I like to blame everything on anesthesia. My mother-in-law says every time you go under anesthesia, you're never quite right again. And I've never been quite right anyway, but my memory just can get really out there. But my whole life has turned upside down in the last few years. It's just been a most amazing situation for me. On the one hand, I've been through experiences that I just simply never dreamed that I would ever survive, that I would ever care to, and I wouldn't have been there to even participate in. At the same time, with the suffering that I have experienced, not just on my own, but also watching other people go through things, the most incredible experience has been to see the reverse side and to experience God at an even deeper level. So what I'm going to talk about today, I don't even really know because I don't know where this will carry me. I hope I don't get too emotional. I'm very emotional, and I may just cry, but I've long since stopped apologizing for that because that's just part of the gift that God's given me to express appreciation. But this program has taken me to heights that I never dreamed possible in my life. And if I had ever myself tried to put limits on what I thought my sobriety would be, I would have really sold myself short. I can tell you that today. But I was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, a middle child. I used to blame that. I at one time thought that was the reason I was an alcoholic, because I read a book that said being a middle child could be very devastating to us emotionally. I was wedged in between two brothers. One, my older brother, was the most popular kid in school. He was the captain of the football team, the president of the senior class and all his classes. He had unbelievable scores of friends, and just everything he touched just seemed to work for him, and outgoing. And he eventually would become a highly decorated military man and have a fine family. And he drank occasionally, but it's not anything important to him. He could take it or leave it, and I've never really seen him drink that much. He's had lots of untold tragedy in his life, and yet he seems to have survived it well. My younger brother was essentially the same way. He had lots of friends, and he was we come from a very athletic family. My dad was a very athletic man. He was a coach, and among all the other things that he managed to accomplish in his life, and my younger brother got along well. But here I am somewhere in the middle, and I became an alcoholic, a drug dealer, a drug addict, a prostitute, a liar, a cheat, and anything else that you can think of. I went to the gutter, and I never could quite figure that out. You know, we were all raised in the same house. What happened here? But I was mentally ill. Mental illness is my thing. You know, you can go to Skid Row physically, or you can go to Skid Row in your mind, and I'm just never quite sure. I almost wish sometimes that I had acted out physically some of the things that had gone in my head and gotten caught early on, and maybe the hell that I went through would have not had to have lasted so long. On the other hand, I wouldn't have what I had today if I hadn't gone through everything that I went through. So I'm quite grateful for that. But my personality was split from the start. I was thinking alcoholically a long time before I took a drink. And as I've always said, at Thanksgiving, nobody ever knew quite how many plates to set because they didn't know how many of me was going to show up. And they never knew which one was going to show up. So that always kept everybody on edge. I have affected people in my life, all of my life. And I was thinking of excuses as to why I wasn't an alcoholic. And that's what just about killed me in this program, as Kim read in More About Alcoholism, is nobody likes to admit. Well, I couldn't admit. I simply couldn't admit. And I mentioned the excuses that I used to use. I had proof that I wasn't an alcoholic necessarily because last year I went through some boxes that contained papers from all the doctors, and I had been to like 15 psychologists and psychiatrists in my life, and I listed all of those things because it just fascinated me as to what doctors had been saying about me all my life, that I was neurotic, which is very neurotic. I'm the poster child for neurosis today. And obsessive compulsive, I seem to grow more so than I ever have been. Passive aggressive, I had attachment disorder, abandonment disorder, schizoid alienation, that's pretty serious, paranoia, manic depression, and they even some guy said that I had a responsibility disorder, that I took too much or not enough. So that, and I, with all those labels, I just say I'm a passionate person. I like to cover it all with passion. I'm just, I'm passionate. But just that, not one of them said I was an alcoholic. Now, I never mentioned that I drank, and nobody asked. I remember once going to a marriage counselor with my husband, and we were there because I thought, finally somebody's going to see what this man is like. And we're there to supposedly save our marriage, and the first thing out of that guy's mouth was to my husband, he said, "Now you go home, because we don't need you here. I got to deal with her first. She's a time bomb of ready to explode." And it's like, damn, nobody understands. And that's the story of my life. You just don't understand. And most people don't understand. And it's not important that they do. What's important is that I understand who and what I am. And that's true. In recent years, I've had an absolute privilege as a result of what you've given me. I've always been so self-absorbed, it's just incredible. There's been no room in my life for anybody else but me for a long, long time. I drank for 25 years, and this is just all about me. Everything in life is about me. But fortunately, you've been able to pry me open somewhat and make me realize that that ain't it at all, and that's not what's going to save my life. It's going to be getting out of me. But one thing I've been privileged to be able to do is to be able to be with my parents and my mother. I have recently, and I'll tell you about this a little bit later, but I've recently discovered this woman. And there in front of my eyes all these years, the most incredible example of anything you could ever dream of. Just a really incredible, remarkable human being. She's 88 years old, and I've been around her, and I've been around Bill's mom. Bill's mom is 83. And watching these two people operate, another thing no doctor ever mentioned was maybe why I was so goofy was being Southern. And this is important because when in relation to this program, because I came in here and you talked about being restored to sanity. Well, the truth of the matter is, in the South, being sane is not that does not necessarily impress Southerners. Because being crazy is kind of a little bit or a lot part of the Southern pride, you know. And schizophrenia we've raised to a fine art, kind of that, you know, that back and forth and that split personality. And you've got to think of the people, the Southerners, and you watch your movies where Southerners are involved, and you listen to them. You listen to them real carefully. As far as gossiping goes, they don't gossip. They just tell stories, and they tell big stories, and they exaggerate stories. But honesty, you talked about having to get honest. And I've mentioned this before because I think it's so precious. I heard my mother-in-law, Bill, recently asked her one day about a particular pot in the kitchen. He said, "Mom, where did you get that?" And she said, "It's so-and-so's, this friend of hers." She said, and he just laughingly said, "Did you steal it?" And she said, "Well, of course not. It just took up with me." Well, that's the same thing. My mother's the same way. She sees things like that. And they rationalize and justify, and that's the subject closed. You talked about me having to write an inventory. Are you kidding? An inventory and tell it to somebody else. Talk about those things to somebody else. That goes so much against the grain of the way I was raised. It was incredible. You don't tell those things. I had a cousin who was divorced for 15 years before we ever knew about it. And he was remarried. And my mother just whispered, "We just didn't want to talk about that." You know, it's things like that that, as far as grandiosity and pride, you know, dealing with that, my mother, you never talk to her and mention somebody's name that she doesn't ask who their people are, where they came from, lineage, you know, it's just real important. Appearances and manners are absolutely everything. My mother was recently in the hospital, she fell and broke her hip, and even though she's laying there in pain, she was introducing me to every nurse that came in that room. And it's just that kind of stuff that you grow up with, and I've watched it so carefully over the years, and I always said that I thought the reason Southern women didn't get involved in orgies was because there'd be too many thank you notes to write. And this is true. We write thank you notes for everything. Absolutely important. It's important. And cursing is not okay. It's okay to throw a fit, to be petulant, to be vindictive, to be high-strung. My heroes early on in my life are always, you know, all Southern little girls see Gone with the Wind when they're little girls. It's almost a rite of passage. And Scarlett O'Hara, and then later on Blanche DuBois, who make being mentally ill just look real attractive. And these women are not shallow, and they are not really crazy. They know exactly what they're doing, and they get away with it. And perceptions of reality, it's not even bad. It's necessary to change it sometimes. So, you know, these are things that, as far as the cursing goes, I said that I spoke at a place in Pennsylvania one time, and they had a rule for the speakers couldn't curse from the podium. And I thought, I was indignant, because I said, I wouldn't curse from the podium. I might steal your husband or kill somebody, but I'm not going to curse from the podium. It's just my mentality, you know. But anyway, and of course the Civil War, the past is not only past, it's not dead, it's not even past, and we get Confederate Memorial Day off, by the way, and Robert E. Lee's birthday, and it's just stuff like that, and it's all comical, but I can see more the older I get. And Atlanta has grown to be not the charming place that it used to be. Atlanta was the only safe haven that I ever had. It was my home. I was born there, raised there. I never left there. I never tried a geographic. Somehow I felt security there. But Atlanta has become so cosmopolitan that I almost can't wait to get out of there one of these days. But when I was thinking of one of my most favorite jokes when we were coming through the Atlanta airport yesterday, about Southern women, and I just love this joke, and y'all forgive me, because it's just funny to me about I find myself bitching about Yankees in Atlanta now, you know, and I'm sounding just like my mother, but they've invaded Atlanta. But there were three women sitting on a bench in an airport in New York, and two Yankees and a Southern lady, and she looked over at them, and in her cheerful way, you know, she just asked them. We always talk to everybody, but said, "Oh, where y'all from?" And one of them looked at her and said, "We're from a place where we don't end sentences and prepositions." And so she thought for just a minute, and she smiled cheerfully and said, "Oh, okay. Well, where y'all from, bitch?" We do have our ways. All you need for delusion to be a reality is to be around other people who are similarly deluded. So don't sell us short. But anyway, one thing too, it seems like, and maybe these things cut across the board and go across any nationality, any culture, anything, but Southern women love their daddies and they love their granddaddies, and we're named after them even. I was named after my grandfather, and indeed these two men would play the most important vital roles in my life, and they would affect my thinking, my action, my behavior, and why I'm here today. And this past year, it's been just almost come full cycle. I know I haven't, but it feels that way to a degree. As I said, I was thinking alcoholically a long time before I ever took a drink. And the first memory that I have, I think, is probably one of the most vital memories I ever had. And it had to do with my grandfather. And my grandfather that I was named after, his name was Marshall, and I was named Marcia. And apparently I was very, very special to this man and very, very loved by this man, because I remember it. And I know it today. I feel it today. And for most of my life, until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I never had that feeling. I never even came close to that feeling, because it was as close to unconditional love as I could ever imagine what that would mean. I know today also that no human being is capable of unconditional love. I myself am not, and nobody in this room is. But God is the only one who can give us the unconditional love that is necessary and that's vital to our lives, and He can indeed do it. He has to do it through us, and we have to be available and clear enough for Him to flow through us. But I remember this man so vividly. I remember everything about him physically. I remember holding his hand. I remember being with him. And the memories must be very deep and very strong, because he died when I was 3 years old. And I remember the funeral. And again, being from the South, this situation, and people do it in other places too, but we have the open coffin funerals and the songs they sang, and I remember the undertaker picking me up to look at him in the coffin to see that he was really gone. And that must have made a big difference in my life, because from that time on, if I look back at my life, and when I had to do a four-step and had to, I could see that even the earliest years of my life, I was not destined to live this life as this life would demand of me. I did not have the emotional strength or whatever it takes to be able to do it. And the fears of being abandoned, the fears of loss, the fear of death, the fear of fear, every kind of fear began back then. And it was only accentuated because I remember that one of the earliest prayers I ever learned was, "Now I'd lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take." And I was so afraid, I was afraid to sleep. Years later, the way I would handle that was I would become addicted to amphetamines, which ran hand in hand with the alcoholism, so I didn't have to sleep. And I would go for just one time, I went for almost a year, it seemed, without sleeping, because I was scared to death and I didn't know what a soul was. My dad's a Southern Baptist minister, and I used to blame that. I used to blame the fact that I was a Southern Baptist minister for being an alcoholic, I just kept using that. That was my biggest resentment and my biggest excuse. But there was never a drop of alcohol served in our home. My parents didn't drink. There was no alcohol in the home. I'm not from an alcoholic family that I could ever see. Now, I know I have uncles and relatives that drank and got in bad trouble, but they were good old boys who were just curious. That's what people used to call them. And there was a lot of insanity that ran in my family, but it was never labeled alcoholism. That word was foreign to me. That we didn't curse, we didn't smoke, we didn't drink. We went to church every Sunday and Wednesday night, and that's the way my life was. My parents encouraged education. Both parents were, my dad was a biblical scholar, and he had master's degrees and PhDs, and my mother was highly intelligent. And these people encouraged education, and that we do try to make something of ourselves, and that we go to school, we be part of the community, and that we take music lessons, and that we do all of the things that give you an opportunity to have a decent life. They didn't have much financially, but they used every bit of it to enable us to do these things. Of course, I never saw that. All I saw, you know, people talk about how badly some people who do come from horribly abusive homes, and that this does affect us. This affects our thinking. It affects our behavior later on in life. And I was all resentful because I came from a good home, for heaven's sake. So an alcoholic, you know, how can you figure it? But early on, I had all of these feelings and emotions, and my daddy was my most, oh, my God, I love that man so much. And I would try every way I could possibly do to please him and to make him happy and to make him say, "I love you," and to let him know, and have him put his arms around me and tell me how important I was. That was necessary for me for some reason early on. But I also wanted to be a part of, and I wore glasses when I was 7 years old. And back then in the 50s, they had this, I think it's Dorothy Parker who said, "Men don't make passes at girls who wear glasses." And that's true. That was then. They do now. But I didn't. Anyway, back then that was not, it was not the, you know, glasses were considered just something ugly. So I took that to heart, and I took to heart that I couldn't be like the other kids. Little things like the other girls, the cheerleaders. I always hated cheerleaders. You know, I was destined for movies, because these movies about the girl who wants to get even because she was the cheerleaders made her feel bad, so she goes and kills all the cheerleaders. And I wanted to at some point in my life, but they could turn cartwheels and I couldn't. But I'd want to kill myself. I learned later to want to kill somebody else instead of myself. But anyway, that's just a childhood. And I mention all that stuff because I took my first drink of alcohol when I was 9 years old. So it was just, thank God for that drink of alcohol. Alcohol and Alcoholics Anonymous have been the two in between has been in response to. But I took a drink of alcohol because a friend of mine's mother happened to have a tea glass of alcohol, bourbon, and said, did I want some? And I took it just to, yes, because I wanted to be a part of, I wanted to fit in, and I took the drink. And from that time on, for the next 25 years, until it began to turn on me, I would chase the feeling that that drink gave me, that very first drink. I remember the feeling. I've always been so anxious and so full of frustration, and I think frustration could probably be the word that could define me. I've always felt like I had one foot nailed to the floor. I could never quite succeed in anything I ever did. But what alcohol did for me, what it did to me was what it does to every other human being. It makes you sick. But I was willing to endure that. I was willing to endure the indignities. I was eventually willing to endure the total insanity that it brought about because I began to believe the lie that alcohol would solve my problems and would not only solve my problems but would give me a whole new way of living. And it did. It did. It gave me a whole new personality, and I was able to feel okay, and eventually not only okay. You see, I'd have these feelings of inferiority. Eventually they would become feelings of superiority. And I would grow to, and I would soon, very early in my life, develop a system of defense against the world, against you, against God. And I could defy every one of you, and I would do anything I wanted to because I would have that friend, and alcohol was the best friend I ever had. And when you told me that I had to not drink anymore, you see, the first step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that I can't drink and I can't not drink. Well, after all the years of drinking, I did not have the power within me to generate the ability to not drink, and that's where you came in. But I was able to drink successfully for a long time and to control the world outside of me because I knew that if I could just do that, then I would be all right. And I looked outside of me all those years for the comfort and for what I needed to be whatever it was that I wanted to be. And I had some dreams and hopes. I used to want to be a singer. I used to want to be an actress and a writer. And during those years, Connie Francis was the big singer in the 50s, and she had a song, Who's Sorry Now? And that became my theme song. Somebody's going to pay for this, but Who's Sorry Now? Elvis Presley, the last time I was in Las Vegas was in the early 70s, and I sat just right here, and he was just right there, and I just about died. He was my first love, and I've never gotten over Elvis Presley to this day. I miss him terribly, but just one of these emotional, sentimental people. But you know, eventually all of that would be killed too, because alcohol numbs the pain, but it also numbs the feelings that we're supposed to have and the things that make us human and make us good and help us to grow. In high school, I added to the alcohol. When I started drinking alcohol, I had to start lying, of course, to get alcohol, to sneak around and to do it. And I began to develop these character defects that I would have to come to terms with later. And it would be very difficult because they were so ingrained in me. But the lying, the cheating, and eventually I added stealing and the shoplifting, and I was part of a theft ring in high school. And I got away with all these things, and alcohol would fuel this false notion and the power. It gave me power, some sense of power and strength and courage to do the things that I needed to do, all to fit in, all to be a part of, and that feeling of superiority. By the time I skipped a grade in high school, and I just was going to have to go to college. That was demanded of us by our parents, and I was getting ready to go to college, and I made a declaration because I got away with things and you didn't catch on to it. So that meant I was smarter than you were. And I sure didn't need that family, and I didn't need those parents. I didn't know then that I was going to set out to punish my father for everything he was worth, for every moment that he never gave me, for everything that he ever denied me emotionally. And I would set out to punish him, and I would do a good job of it. But with that, I would punish myself and everybody that I touched. The big book talks about if a person has cancer, we just feel sorry for him, and we wouldn't criticize him. But with the disease of alcoholism, comes the annihilation of everything that we hold dear, and the destruction of people and everything that we've ever cherished and that could have meant anything to us. But I made a declaration when I was 16 years old that would change my life forever, and that was that as I went out the door to go to Auburn, which is in Alabama, that I would never again darken the door of a church, that the God that I had been raised with, that I had tried, I'd tried to do what I was supposed to do, and I'd been to Sunday school, but that hadn't taken, and there obviously was no God. If he was there, though, if indeed he was there, then he'd given me brains to think and to use, so he meant for me to run my own life. And that's what I did for the next 20, however many years, until I came into this program through the gates of hell. And that's where my will took me, and that's where my ego began to grow and to flourish. And you know, the ego is the part of the mind that focuses on the personality and the body, and thus separates us from the spiritual. And that's when it began to really happen for me. And I believe today that for every drink that I would put into my body, and if you've been in and out of this program, every time you take a drink of alcohol, that instantly separates you from the spiritual, from God. And but anyway, I made that declaration, and today I know that I can't separate myself from God because God's here, he's inside of me, but I can bury him so alive that he cannot see the light of day, and that he's not going to take away my will. We talk about willpower and giving our will over to the care of God. I don't think that we give necessarily, I don't think he's going to take my will, because he's given it to me as a vehicle in order to make choices. And willpower is simply the strength of the choices that I'm able to make. So I don't know that he's going to take my will, but I do know that I need to turn my will around and align it with his, and to do what he's wanting me to do. But in order to do that, I got to get out of the way. There's so many paradoxes in this program. I went to Auburn and based armed with that idea and that declaration of freedom. And I've talked about it before, but that was a horrible, horrible time. I tried to fit in there and didn't, and I really didn't care at that stage. I would find myself later on in the chapter of the agnostic, and that was the one chapter that I did not read for years in this program. But I got in trouble with the Auburn football team, and I don't even go into that anymore, but that's... the prostitution by then had taken hold, and I went to the gutter. I absolutely went to the gutter as a human being, and unrecognizable as the daughter of the people from whence I came, and from the community, and from the values. And I came home, and because my daddy insisted that I have a college education. And so I did get a college degree. I got 4 degrees in psychology and sociology, history and political science. Not because I'm so smart, but because I thought Daddy would be pleased with one of those. And the day I graduated, he said, "Well, why didn't you get a degree in business?" The one thing I didn't do. I did open a business. Of course, everything in my life has been either for or against whatever my dad wanted. And I opened a business, and I ran a successful business for a few years, but my alcoholism destroyed that too. I had a child. I married the right man. I say the right man because my daddy liked him, and he was a good man. He's a very loving man. He's highly intelligent, very handsome, and very capable of taking care of me. And by that time, by my early 20s, my alcoholism was full-blown. And the way I drank was simply, I loved bourbon. I had a favorite bourbon, George Dickel. I don't know if anybody's ever been familiar with that. And I loved beer. And I had set up my life to where I could, and at that time it was a reward for me. I would take amphetamines during the week to function and to do things and to be superhuman, superwoman. And this notion of grandiosity and habit perfectionism was, all of my defects were just accelerated. And to drink, I would drink to relax eventually and to get rid of the anxiety caused, you know, by all of this cycle of insanity that's building. And eventually I would not have a choice in the matter, and alcohol would be the only thing that it wouldn't work anymore. Actually, it didn't. It stopped working because I was more anxious and more frustrated and sicker, and my behavior was worse. And life was just becoming untenable. I could not hold on much longer. And I was going insane. And my marriage, though I married the right man and I had the right child, I felt nothing with either one of them. My ability to love, I believe the ability to reason is eroded the minute I take a drink. and the ability to love. If I had any at all, it was dead. So I went through my life pretty much that way, and I came to the jumping off place the first time because of the way life had turned out, physically, emotionally, financially. I was so beaten in all the areas, and of course spiritually, in 1981, and I was sent to a treatment center because I was told I was an alcoholic. And for a second that sounded good because it was a name for what was going on, but it didn't last very long because of all the reasons I told you. I couldn't be an alcoholic. But I had just used up everything and everybody, and it's like we come to a place where, how did this happen? Well, I went into treatment center, and for the first 2 years in this program, nothing changed. I lived like a drunk, I acted like a drunk, thought like a drunk. I just didn't take a drink, and now I know today that the grace of God, He's really loved me. He has loved me so that I didn't drink, and I don't understand why, except to know that I needed to be beaten down and beaten and bludgeoned to the bottom. And I was at 2 years of sobriety. I had come to meetings, and I came here because you seemed to want me to be here. You seemed to know I was an alcoholic, and you didn't throw me out. And though you didn't leave me, and I could eventually came to trust you like no other. I came to find unconditional love here because it's given to us. God's here, and He loves me through you, and the same goes we do it to each other. But I came into this program and immediately got involved with a man, a married man, because after all, when I have to give up drugs and alcohol, the next step is going to be that man. And I did do some things. I never opened the books. I never read the literature. I didn't know the steps in order. I had no clue. But it just kept me, but you know, alcoholism's progressive, whether we're emotionally, and I came to that jumping off place. I came to that insanity. I can't live with alcohol and I can't live without it. I can't drink and I can't not drink. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I reached another momentous decision in my life. But I had come to a convention just like this. I love these conventions. I really do. And when I'm asked to do anything, I learn in Alcoholics Anonymous never to say no. I did it in the beginning not understanding why. I've done a lot of things in this program that I didn't understand why. But when I got to the place where I knew I didn't have to understand that, I'd just do it. I've learned the benefits of it. And I happened to have been at a convention one night, just like something like this. And I didn't want to be there, but my sponsor had said to be there. And because I was still people-pleasing, but, you know, sponsor-pleasing is not people-pleasing. Sponsors, they got some God in them. But I did what she said. And at that point, I didn't care if she liked me or not, but I just didn't want to have to hear it. I didn't want to incur her wrath. So if you got a sponsor who you just can't stand, that's okay. It doesn't matter. If she's working this program and working the steps and telling you things to do, just get over having her tell you what to do and saying, nobody's going to tell me what to do, because God's speaking to you through her. But I showed up there, and I heard a speaker, and it happened to be Clancy, and I heard the message. And I believe that each and every one of us, we tell each other. God has told everybody in this room something that I need to know today, that's going to help me heal me and help me stay alive and become happily and usefully whole. I know that today, but I hadn't been able to hear. I had been so blind and so sick, and the disease of alcoholism was so deep in me that I had denied, and I couldn't see it. And my reality was outside of me. It had to be in people, places, and things. And if I just had money, if I just had a band, if I just had something. But I never understood where it was going to come from and how you were going to play the part in there. But I heard the message with him about the disease of perceptions, and I had to come to understand that it starts with those faulty, sick perceptions that we have, and that alcohol does indeed alter the perceptions, but mine had become so twisted, but that I'd been acting and I'd been defiant against just that, faulty perceptions. I had been defiant and rebellious and self-destructive against lies, things that I had believed which weren't at all true, at all true. And to this day, I am still discovering how twisted my perceptions are. But from perceptions, of course, thoughts are charged with emotions. And once the emotions, mine have always been so strong, they gave power to those thoughts. And out of those thoughts grew those attitudes. I don't need you. I can do this by myself. And out of those attitudes come the behavior. That's just the way it goes. And I had to learn that. And today I have to recognize that when I have to look at my behavior and see what it is that I'm doing. But anyway, the program began to take hold in my heart, and I don't know why. I guess when we have ears to hear and eyes to see, we do. And that was the time for me at that place. And I know that the ego has to be deflated at death. The ego, which is the Marcia that I created, so that the Marcia that God created can begin to somehow come forth. And I was deflated at that point in time, humbled, if you will. I was beaten and bludgeoned, whatever you want to say. But God was able to somehow get in there and begin to speak to me. And then when the student is ready, the teachers do appear. And they'd always been around me, but I hadn't been able to see. And you begin to come, and things begin to come alive. I began to come alive, and the transformation did begin to take place for me. And the next few years were the most incredible years of my life, and I'll be forever grateful beyond words, beyond measure, to the very people, the very jobs that you gave me to do. And for those, if there's anybody who's new here, if there's anybody who's struggling, or if you're living your life on this continual disturbance and frustration and nothing's ever going right and you just can't get happy, please, just do some simple things that we all hear, but we resist. And it's those very things that are going to change. It changed my life, and I never knew what value it would be to me until this past year. This past year has been the most incredible year of my life. Up until where I stand in front of you today, a few days ago, my life has really been on the line. And in sobriety, and this is where, you know, people, I love the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's the most, next to the Bible, I think the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the finest piece of literature and truth I have ever read in my life. But I also love the 12 and 12, and I'm amazed at a lot of old-timers who don't read it or kind of maybe put it down. And I don't want to incur their wrath, but I love that 12 and 12 because Bill Wilson wrote that when he was 13 years sober and been living 13 years without a drink. And it talks about what it's like to live. It talks about emotional sobriety and how we have to have that too. And how he hadn't gotten it in a lot of the years that he was sober. He said, the one thing I've been missing is emotional sobriety. And I had to have that too, as well as the physical sobriety. And I couldn't just keep going. And I am so grateful for everything that anybody told me to do. I got a sponsor who I wouldn't argue with, and I haven't to this day. And she was the most powerful woman, and she still is. I respect her, and I have tremendous respect for her. And I learned to come to meetings and to do things and to take care of other people and to forget myself and to be involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and to read the literature and to do everything that you hear said, but we just don't do it. And that I was never to say no to any AA request. And that I was to do what I said I was going to do when I said I was going to do it and to be where I said I would be. All of the things, and these are the ways that I would be able to deal with the character defects, and that I would be able to grow and to it would not only expel the obsession to drink, but enable me to be happily and usefully whole. And I had no idea what that concept was even alike. All I wanted to do when I first came in here, I didn't come in here to stop drinking. It was just to get the world off my back. But I was beaten down and beaten into a place of submission. And I don't want to ever have to go back there, but I don't want to ever forget that. I want to talk to y'all this morning the best I can about what has happened to me, because I think the amends step in this program, the steps 8 and 9, will indeed free your soul. They have mine. And I found out who and what I am and what I'm about this past year. I went to a new plane of God, a new level. I experienced God in a way that I never dreamed possible, and it came through making amends. When I was told that I had to make amends and do the amends steps, I made amends the best I possibly could to all of the people that I could in the ways that I had to, financially and in so many ways. It was just an incredible thing because I'd alienated everybody. I lost my marriage, I lost my child, I lost my job, I lost my business, I lost everything financially. So I was beaten to that place too. And that was like 15 years ago out of the 18. I had nothing. I had started my life over again then from ground zero without a penny to my name, without anything, without a family, without anybody. And I had so punished my family, my parents especially, that I had wrecked that family too and friends. And it was just an incredible journey for me. To the bottom and to the gutter. And the one resentment that I had carried so strongly was against my father. I had loved this man. I had tried everything I ever did, and I could see that everything I ever did had been in response to him. And I had never heard, "I love you." I had never felt that I was loved. I could never please him. And it seemed as if it was continual frustration. And I hated him. I hated this man. And I had managed to make his life pretty miserable too, but he seemed to be able to go on. But anyway, I was told that I was going to have to make that amend. And that was the one amend that I refused to do. And I said, there's no way possible, because I couldn't possibly see how that man how I could have hurt him as much as he had hurt me. He had virtually destroyed my life in the ways that, just so many ways that I had believed and I knew to be true. But anyway, through the years, I knew I had to do it. I had to do it. And I'm going to try to be brief with this, because I don't even know. I don't know what I've experienced, and I don't know that I'll know the full impact of it for a long, long time. But the book talks about letting go of old ideas. And the quicker we can let go of as many old ideas as we can, then God's going to be able to do his work, because we're going to clear the clutter out of his way so that he can fully come up inside of us and we can experience being a channel of his peace. And the channel between us can flow when we work the steps of the program. And I learned to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way, because they are ego deflating in depth. Each and every one of them, because they are ego deflating, that voice, the Marcia voice, the ego, can be stilled and be quiet. And God's voice, I can hear his voice with every step that I work. And I believe in the steps. And I believe in step studies and big book studies. But I worked the steps the best I could, and always to this day, my home group is a step study and a big book study, and I have a ladies' meeting as a step study, and I need these things more today than ever. But anyway, this amend kept sticking with me, and it kept being so difficult and so hard. And finally, though, I was told the basic things to do, and I've never quite understood what this over here has got to do with my life. As somebody's always says, change the steps to read the way I want them to read so they'll fit into what I'm needing here. But that's not true. But I was told to begin to do things, to begin to go see these people that I had ignored in the same city, just to see them. I'd go for months and not see them and not call, but just to try to do that and to be of service any way I could, whether I wanted to or not. And through the years, I began to do these things. And not feel anything about it necessarily, but somehow I was just doing what you told me to do. And that would become this past year has been the most critical and the most important journey I've ever taken. Because my dad became ill a few years ago with Parkinson's. And Parkinson's has, I don't know, I think there's 50-something varieties. But this disease would take him to the depths of hell as far as physically. I would come to see the man to where he couldn't blink his eyes, where he couldn't breathe, he couldn't do anything on his own, move a finger or do anything, and to see this powerful, powerful force in my life to be completely destroyed this way. But he became ill, and a few years ago my nephew had died of AIDS. He was 26 years old. He was the first grandson. He was important to me beyond words. He was one of the few people that I could connect with and had loved, and he died. And a couple of years later on Christmas Eve, his mother died of a heart attack. And these were two of the most powerful people in my life. They had meant so much to me. They were two of the few who I had still had any relationship left with, and they died. And here comes that fear, that death and that dying and all the abandonment and don't leave me. And you see, I had long ago established ways to deal with that. If you don't love me, I don't love you. If you're going to leave me, that's fine. Just go on, because I don't need you. And I could feel that. But you enable me to start feeling those things again and to realize that those ideas weren't going to work anymore. But it was very hard for me. And this was in 1996 that my sister-in-law died. Well, my dad by this time had become physically to where he could barely walk. And one night, I had to be the one to tell them that my sister-in-law had died. And they had loved her as much as they ever loved any of us. She was so good to them. She loved them unconditionally, in a way that I mean unconditionally. And she appreciated them for who they were. But I had to tell them about this death. It was very hard, but something very powerful happened as a result of that. And my dad became very ill that night, and I brought him back to Atlanta, and they had moved away, but to sleep, he was sleeping down the hall, and I heard him fall. And here's a 6'2" man on the floor, and he's very sick. And I picked him up with my arms, little me, picked him up, and I carried him into the bathroom, and we were there, and he said, "I'm so sorry you have to see me like this." And I said, "Daddy, this is an honor and a privilege to be able to help you. And we're going to see this thing through." And I made a commitment that night, and I didn't know what I was doing, but it was just because of what you had taught me to do that I was able to even say that. And so for the last few years, and especially the last year, I just went through an experience that I cannot even begin to tell you what it was like, because I became the primary caretaker. I kept that job. I worked for the Georgia State Senate, and I tried to keep my job, and I did. I was able to do that, to keep my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous and to take care of my father. He was 83 years old, and mother, 88. And I drove back and forth. I drove hundreds of miles. I slept on the floor of, there were 8 hospitals that we were in and out of hospitals. I was able to do things physically that I could not possibly do on my own. But most importantly, I was able to pray and ask God for the strength, and He gave it to me on a regular basis, because I had come to trust God's strength and His courage, because I've come to know that on my own I have none. On my own I have nothing. On my own I am nothing. But I know that He's there, and I found Him inside of me as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only thing I have going for me today. And we were able to go through this nightmare, and it was indeed a nightmare. My brothers chose not to participate, and I had a lot of anger and resentment, but I had to know that they were draining me from taking from me the strength I needed with those resentments to take care of Daddy. And we went this way. In the meantime, the people of Alcoholics Anonymous were the most incredible. It was the most incredible experience I have ever seen of giving and caring without asking anything in return and begging me to be able to help me and to help my parents. And you people are the most incredible group of people I have ever known. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most expressive face of God that I have ever seen in every gathering of people. And by January of this year, I have never been so physically, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally worn down completely. At the same time, I have never been so filled up. And it's just the difference with you. You made the difference for me. Daddy died on January the 16th, and I had prayed for months because what he was going through physically, that he not have to suffer the last final indignities of the not being able to blink his eyes, or that he would suffocate. And indeed, God was merciful, because he, one night after he had spent the time he needed talking and doing the things that he needed, and I think God takes each and every one of us when he wants us, and I know that, but Daddy was able one night to just turn over and go to sleep, and I was so grateful to God for that. But the most important thing for me was that when I stood at his grave, I had no amends and no regrets, not a single one. And I had been preparing myself for all of those years in this program and through you to be of maximum service to those people. And I'd made that vow and commitment a long time ago that if God would help me, and because of my thanks to him for what he had given me, which was one more opportunity, that I would get to that place and that I would need the strength and the courage that only he could give me, but I would be able to do that with his help. And I made that commitment that I would see it through no matter what. And I was able to do it. During this time last year, some terrible things happened, because I had always wanted a best friend. I'd always wanted to be special, this one person. And that's where that daddy thing came in. I know today I'm special to God, and each and every one of you are too, and I don't have that need anymore. But I had had that, and I had had a best friend in this program. Well, she took off and left last year because she decided this was too much for her. She told somebody that she thought she had had the best years of Marcia, which was in my early in every way. But she took off, and for a moment I had that feeling one more time that you don't get too close and don't trust anybody, and that won't happen. But it passed, because I had all of you, and I had so many sweet, sweet babies. I wish I could name every single one of the women that I sponsored, because they last year sponsored me. This young lady up here calls me sponsor, but I could not have lived without her last year. She is the voice of calm and the voice of reason and the voice of Alcoholics Anonymous when I need it, and I have needed it so desperately. Because I did exactly what I had to do last year, but it took its toll on me. And I was in a head-on car collision last August. I was diagnosed with a kidney tumor last year. And just recently I was talking today about I had some cancer surgery for what they thought was a cancer, and we have one more biopsy out there that's we're waiting on the results, and I'm not going to call the doctor today because I don't need to do that, but I could call him today to find out, but so what? I'm going to do whatever it is I have to do. One of the things he told me not to do for several months, and I never breathed a word of it at home because I was afraid somebody would hold me to it, but he said, you cannot do any traveling for 6 months to a year. He said, don't go anywhere, especially those long AA trips. And so I'm doing what the doctor says some ways. I'm trying to get my rest here and there. He said, don't lift anything that's over 5 pounds, like a 5-pound bag of sugar in my suitcase yesterday, you know, weighed 100 pounds. But I'm here today because I believe that everybody that crosses my path and who crosses and whose path I cross, I think we're in this deal. I think God's here, and this is the way that we heal and that we are healed. I believe that. I know that. I know it without question. But this whole year for me took its toll. And thank you, God. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for having given me the training in the early years, for having opened my mind, prying my mind open. Forgot to mention, back in the 60s, I was a war protester, and I dealt drugs and pot, and I protested the Vietnam War, and I carried signs and everything. And I've always said that my mind got so open, you know, your mind can get so open that your brains fall out. And that happened, but you opened my mind in the way that God wants my mind to be open, and kept it open, and you've kept it open. And I haven't necessarily done very well. And I've learned, though, that I don't have to do very well. As long as I stay sober and do the best I can, that however I'm feeling today, which is probably in my 18 years of sobriety, I'm at the most teachable place I've ever been. I'm at the most helpless place. And that's where God usually wants me. That's good for me. It's not necessarily good for you, because you want to hear somebody up here who's probably strong and got it racked together. But I'm right where I'm supposed to be. And I'm not hopeless, so I know everything's going to be okay, because I'm going to be okay. And you've given me that hope. Without it, there's no need to keep going. But it took its toll. Everything took its toll on me. And I want to share with you one last thing, because I had the surgery recently, and that was very frightening. And there's some things very frightening to me that would frighten anybody about physically. I can't see how it could have been different, though, because physically I pushed myself beyond limits last year. But emotionally and mentally, I hurt a lot of people this past year. And in making the amends to my parents and to my dad, I created some problems, because sometimes situations that cause these things, that we have to take actions and we worry later. But there were people who just refused to participate, and I had to do some things that the rest of the family didn't necessarily agree with. But I found myself about a month ago, where it says on page 52 in the big book, right back where I was when I was 2 years sober, as far as emotionally and spiritually. And I was having trouble with everybody, and I was having trouble living my life and every way with my job. They had been so good to me at work, but I didn't want to be at work anymore, and the depression was so strong, and the fear and the anxiety and resentments had grown, and I just have to get rid of those things. But I did the thing that I was taught to do a long, long time ago. And I'm telling you what, when we follow a few instructions, then they're instructions and they're requirements. But if we just do these things, then we've got a chance. But I wrote an inventory, and I went right back through these steps, and I took that inventory to Maggie's bedside. She's been very ill for a long time. But I got on my knees with her, and I laid up on that bed with her, and I talked for hours and hours and hours. And I went through every defect of character. You see, this last year brought out every principle that you've ever taught me, but it brought out every character defect also. And I've had to go right back to the beginning, and that's where I am today. I know that I can't drink and I can't not drink. And I know that in order to be restored to sanity, I'm going to have a power greater than me. And that my will and my life is my thinking and my actions, and I'm going to have to let you have it. And I'm so grateful, because you got it. It's yours. I made that that exchange a long time ago, and I'm not taking it back no matter what. You're going to have so many great speakers this weekend, and I just can't wait to hear them, because to hear what God's got on His mind for me. And I'm going to go away from here healed. The last place I spoke was in Huntsville, Alabama. And if you think this talk has been disjointed, that one was so incredible because I fell apart right in the middle of it. It was two weeks after Daddy died, and I was just at that verge of collapse emotionally and physically. And right in the middle of that talk, I just lost it. And that's not happened to me. That pride and that ego of being able to go on the circuit, and if nothing else, I may not tell you anything meaningful, but most of the time I can amuse you and charm you. But that day I couldn't amuse, I couldn't charm, and I couldn't say anything meaningful except that I'm hurting. And I'm hurting bad. But you know, Bob was there, and that blessed Clint H., and I wish I could say his last name. I love that man because he was there. There's no coincidences in this program. Butch and this committee didn't know a year ago how badly I would need this meeting and this conference. How could they know? The people who asked me to Huntsville didn't know that I would need Clint and Bob so much that day, because Clint happened to be on the program the 2 years before when I had spoken a month after my sister-in-law had died on Christmas Eve. And I know these things aren't coincidences, and that everybody in here has got something I need. And I need you today. I love you more than I've ever loved you, and I need you more than I've ever needed you. And for those of you who are monkeying around and playing with this program, I wish you luck. And for those of you who say you don't know about a God and can't get a God, just look at the person right next to you. Just listen. Just listen in a meeting. And just try to keep an open mind about it. I want to say thank you for letting me be here today. I didn't say anything that I wanted to say, that maybe one day I'm going to be able to give that talk. I give it to myself in the car all the time. And I've even thought of having a tape recorder going all the time. But I've got this thing that I say to myself, somebody's boring me and I think it's me. So I'm going to sit down and I'm going to be quiet. But I want to tell you how much I thank you. My parents, thank you. My daddy, thank you. This morning, when we were little, one of the opportunities that Daddy gave us, you see, as I grew in this program to know this man, I was able to write as a bit blinded to him what I refused to see. He was one of the finest men, most integrity-filled people I've ever known, and what an opportunity that I had missed and cut myself off from. But one of the things he did for us when we were children that I had never seen or appreciated was that he took us on trips. He made sure that we traveled, and he worked several jobs in order to see that we had everything we needed, and I never appreciated that. One of the things he did was take us out west. He loved the west. He had stacks and stacks and stacks of Arizona Highway magazines that we had to throw away or get rid of or do something with when he died, and I didn't want to get rid of them because they were so much a part of him. But he took us to the Grand Canyon when we were little. And he used to talk about the Colorado River. And I looked out this morning, I saw that river, and I called my mom. I said, I'm so close to the Grand Canyon, I'm so close to the Colorado River. I'm so close to those mountains that Daddy loved so much. I wish he were here. And of course she reminded me, he is here. He's here. And I'm so grateful to you, and I thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. There's one lady on the West Coast that carries this label, and the label she carries is the first lady in AA on the West Coast. Her name is Sybil, and she's from Los Angeles, and let's welcome her.
Thank you, Gail, and thanks to the committee. Everyone on the committee has been terribly good to me, including Gail, and I'm always so amazed and so surprised that I should get any attention at all, because I'm just like you. I mean, I drank in very poor bars and rotten bootlegging stuff and got drunk and had to be hauled home. And now I get called the oldest woman west of the Rockies or something like that. And you know, and I know that at my age and after my experience in AA and having been sober and hugged and kissed and loved as much as this, that if I got drunk now, it would kill me. Kill me right away. I wouldn't even linger around very long. Because next month I'll be 79 years old. Last month, I celebrated my 46th. I wonder how that must sound for the young members. I'm talking about age, the 15, 16, 18, 20, 25 year old kids, young people who come in now, and they see Grandma Moses up here, you know. And they'll think, well, my gosh, you know, it's just not possible to ever, you know, live to be that old and not have a drink in 46 years. Yeah, it's possible, but it doesn't mean that it's always just moonlight and roses and untold wealth and good health and make a lot of money and always look good to the people and say the right things and nothing bad can ever happen to you because you don't drink now. And then I look around and think about my mother and my father, and they never did drink. And they never had any good times, particularly. So here I am, supposed to be a little unique, I suppose, because I've hung around so long. But I intend to be here for a long time. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that must be the Oxnard table there. I think I see the Garcias. And I'll tell you about the Garcias. I was married to a compulsive gambler, and that's part of my long name of Sybil Doris Adam Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Corwin. And when it got to the Willis part, my daughter Addie, who came down especially to be here from Northern California, is laughing. She's been sober 5 years, 5 miraculous years, Addie Williams. And she was laughing about Jim Willis, who started the gambling, non-gambling program, Gamblers Anonymous, so successfully, as her step-step-stepfather. Or is it two steps? I've kind of forgotten how many steps there were packed on that. They were terribly fond of each other. And he was a great man. And these people from Oxnard, in his last year, he spent in a rest home a block from their home, the Garcias. And do you know the Tony and Tony trudged over there every day of Jim's life, and I don't think you knew these people before today, Addie, that they lived there in Oxnard. They knew what a wonderful thing that he had done for so many gamblers that killed themselves and literally cut their throats because there was no way out. And he wrote the book, and he did the meeting directory, and he traveled around the country and got GA started all over the country and did a great job. And the Garcias sitting right here had no idea. I thought they'd be invisible out there someplace. So thank you again for meaning so much in our lives. It is so helpful to have people who stick by you when the going is rough. Because as human beings, you know, the human beings all over the world have rough times, and they don't have to get drunk at it or take dope for it and all of that kind of thing. But we've had people stand by us, and looking back over your lives, regardless of your sobriety date, it's a great thing to know that actually that most of us are closer to each other than we are our first cousins, perhaps. Some of us would say mother-in-laws. Others would name distant relatives or the neighbors next door. And yet you know what makes me tick, and I know something about what makes you tick. And I found out early on that if Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work when things got tough, that it wasn't worth a plugged nickel when the sun was shining. It had to work through everything, no matter what. And it does. I hope there's, I don't know where that guy is sitting, that I gave a hug 25 days sober because of the light so I could identify you. And I talked to him and hugged him 10 minutes before the meeting started. And 25 days sober. Can you imagine that? What must he think? of us when we shout and scream and hoop and holler with laughter one moment, and then we get deadly serious when we talk about this alcoholism thing and what it did to our lives, because it is a serious thing, and most of us who come to AA know that there's absolutely no other way out but this permanently, except in a few cases, a religion, but not in the majority of cases, because a lot of us tried religion first. We tried drying out places. We tried lots of things. Tried willpower, that dirty word. Willpower. That's all I ever tried was promises, promises, I won't do it again. I won't be missing for 3 days. I really won't ever drink again. I swear I won't. I promise you I won't. I really mean it. I mean it. I mean it. I'd rather die than drink again. Well, I meant that. But there I was. The longest time I ever stayed sober was 9 days when I hitchhiked out of town with Addie's father, Bill Hart. He was a sailor boy, paid off out of the Navy, didn't have a nickel. And we got married, and Addie was born, and my mother took care of the baby. And when she was 6 months old, we were dead broke, and we hitchhiked out of town and left Addie there with my mother, who was very ill with a heart trouble, and died early on. And we hitchhiked hungover and depressed and poor and didn't want to behave the way we were doing. And we got out as far as Arvin, which is 18 miles this side of Bakersfield in California. Got over the ridge route all right, which was just a muddy trail then. It wasn't a big thoroughfare. And it took us a long time hitching rides on trucks and things to get there. But when we got and we got a cold drink or something there, we slept in a haystack that night. I'd forgotten about that. And the next morning, the man at the little grocery store there where we got some crackers or something to eat, he said, if you want to hitchhike into Arvin, they're picking grapes there, and I think they can use you. So we walked and hitched rides on a little truck full of grapes and one thing and another till we got to Arvin and got a job picking grapes. And the sun was hot, 120 or something like that, and I was sweating. I was very young, and I thought, this is the life. Now I'm away from those drunks and those places and those saloons, and now then I won't have to drink anymore, and Mama will take good care of the baby, and we'll make a little bundle of money here picking these grapes, and when we go back, well, we'll take the baby, and we'll rent the apartment, and I'll have my little girl, and she'll never see her mother drunk. And I worked hard, and I was dirty and sweaty, but happy. And then along about sundown, all of those grape pickers had come from many directions. And they were college kids mostly that were there to earn tuition for the fall. A nice, clean-cut little crowd. And they gathered around and built a bonfire because there wasn't anything else to do except getting their sleeping bag or whatever. And so they built this bonfire, and they started harmonizing. And Bill and I joined the little crowd there, and I thought, now this is the life. Oh, boy, will I be healthy and tan, and I'll be such a good wife and mother when we get back to Los Angeles. And we started harmonizing with them. And then I saw around this big circle of young people, and Bill here and I'm here, I saw a bottle start being passed around the circle, a bottle being passed, and I knew what it was. It was a big, big quart of whiskey. And I knew, and my mouth began to water. I was salivated, and I knew that when that bottle reached me, I watched to the next. I thought, God, I hope there's enough for me. And it finally reached me, and I turned up the bottle and drank the rest of it, the whole thing. And realizing that I had failed once again, I couldn't bear it. I got up from the campfire, and I wandered down the row of grapes, stumbling from one row to the next, just stumbling along with my head down and sobbing and crying. I remember looking up at the moon and praying, oh, God, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? And I never felt such sorrow. My throat just ached from pain. And I finally began to worry and got terribly frightened because I heard this heavenly music in the answer to my prayer. And it was heavenly. It was eerie. And I thought, all right, I've overdone it this time. Now I've got VTs. I've got VTs on top of everything else. Listen to that music. It's so beautiful. And I began to stumble and run to get away from the music, and I couldn't get away from it. It got louder and louder and louder. And so pretty soon, I stumbled upon this big khaki tent out there in an acre that was free of grapevines, and it was the local revival meeting, a church meeting. And all of the townspeople were in there singing hymns, but I didn't know that. And when I reached there, like those double doors there, I parted the flap of the tent, and the music stopped. And the preacher, he was disconcerted, and he looked back in the back to where the exit was, at this dirty face, tears running down my cheeks, this woman standing back there swaying back and forth. And the congregation slowly turned around and gave me the eye. And as he was saying this, if there are any among you who want to be saved, please come forward at this time, which was the cue for the regulars to do this thing, you know. But I was the one who wanted to be saved, and they were really interested in my behavior. And so I staggered and lurched, and they mentally were helping me along, I suppose. And it took me forever and a day to get down there, and they began to sing "Just As I Am" without one plea, and it just nearly killed me in the tears. And I finally got to the altar, and the preacher put his hand out and put it on my head to pray for me, and I threw up all over it. Now, in later years, I did many, 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 many bad things, especially driving a car. But I never had anything, or never heard any story as disgraceful as mine that I threw up on the preacher, because I couldn't bear what I had done. And boy, did I get out of there and hitchhike back to that, to get on the main road to Los Angeles. And a truck came along and stopped, and I got on the truck, and the truck driver felt sorry for me. Everybody seemed to feel sorry for me in those days. Poor little thing, poor little thing. And so I got on the truck, and he took me to my mother's door. He heard my sad story, and there was Mama taking care of Daddy the best that she could. And that was just one little tale out of my youthful past. I was so young. And would vigorously deny it to everybody that, well, I didn't do anything. I was very defiant. Don't tell me what to do. And yet I'd go and suffer, suffer, suffer. And do it again, do it again. And then when I would get in my car and lurch off down to the beaches someplace and get terribly drunk and terribly sick and hide my bottle in the sand at a beach party where the others were behaving themselves and toasting weenies or something, I would have my bottle down, packed down in the sand where I could haul it out and get drunk, and they'd wonder, well, where'd she get all that stuff anyway? They didn't have any to speak of. And I just misbehaved terribly. And so then I got in the car in my wet bathing suit, and I started back towards Los Angeles. And the squad car beamed their lights at me. And I had been terribly sick all over my bathing suit on the front seat of the car. And I was just, make it home, kill me. And the squad car stopped, and I looked so bad that instead of throwing me in jail like they do these days, they said, we're going to follow you, lady. Get going and drive slowly. And they followed me, and I began to straighten up a little bit and straighten up a little bit, and then they got ahead of me and said, follow us, and they took me to my door because I'd given them my name and address. Now, they don't do that these days. They do not. You know that. And so I must have been a pitiful sight, but they felt sorry for that poor little thing, and they shouldn't have, because on the other hand, if I was in a different mood and I was in a bar, if somebody said something I didn't like, I'd clobber them, I'd hit them, I'd get thrown out in 86. Don't come back here anymore. And there were a lot of bars I couldn't go in because I always started to fight and wind up out in the sidewalk just yelling and screaming and being crazy. One time when I left the bar, I left before 2:00, and I only lived 2 blocks from this car, this bar, and I was at the stage to where that I knew I'd make it home all right, but I would have to run a little bit and fall down. And I'd get up and I'd run a little bit and I'd fall down. And I'd run a little bit and lay there a little while. I'd get up and I'd run, make a good little run of it, and then I would fall down. And I kept this up for 2 blocks, and when I got to our house where Addie was cozily sleeping with the housekeeper now to take care of her because I couldn't, we just had hired her, dear Mrs. Stevens, who was with us then for quite a while. And I would run, and I would stumble, and I would get up, and I'd go. And I got to our steps, and as I went up the steps, I looked back, and my nylons were off and trailing down the steps, and only my foot was in the heel of the nylon. And I had been trailing those in back of me all the way from the bar. And I didn't feel very happy about all that. And yet I would pray. I'd pray for help. Oh, God, please don't let me behave like this. What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? I can't bear it. And so one day I got in my car very depressed, and I drove up over that ridge route and went to San Francisco and got there daylight and looked around and barely daylight, and there wasn't even any place to get a drink, and I wondered why I am here. I don't know anyone. I want to go home. I turned around, and I got back on the ridge route, and not very prosperous days then, and the fellow who looked like he wasn't such a bad guy raised his hand for a ride, as they will do, and I pulled over because I could drive no longer. I was exhausted. I wanted to get home and see Addie, and so finally he got in the car, and I said, can you drive? He said, yeah, and I said, I have to have some sleep, and take me to Los Angeles, and he says, that's where I'm going, and so I got in the back seat and went to sleep, and finally, somebody was shaking me, lady, wake up, we're in Los Angeles, here we are at 6th and Hill, I'm going to leave you here, because I have to go down to Skid Row, that's where I belong. He says, you're here at 6th and Hill, can you hear me? And I said, yeah, and so he left. And I looked to see where I was at 6th and Hill, and my eyes were blurred, and I read the sign there. It said, Sultan Turkish Bath. And I thought, I was pudgy in those days. My face was very full, my arms were pretty big, my legs were big, my body was not that large, but I was out of proportion. And I thought, I'll take a Turkish bath like I used to when my brother teased me, and I would take off 5 pounds real quick with a Turkish bath before I put it back on in a week. And I thought, that's that place where I used to take those baths. I'll go in there and sober up, and I'll go home, and I'll look good. And then I can tell them that I went up to San Jose to look at a prune ranch that was a good buy, and I was in the real estate business then, and that's why I was out of town, and I can cook up the story, and the housekeeper will believe it, and I can get my foot in the door one more time, because Dick had said he wouldn't put up with it. And so I didn't want to go down there and think. I wanted to turn my head off, and I looked at the newsstand there, how handy. I wanted something to read after the Turkish bath, which takes quite a while. And I would stay there all night, and the next morning I would put on my makeup, go home and wouldn't have the shakes, and I'd be okay. And I wouldn't get in any worse trouble than I was in. So I thought, I'll read, and I just grabbed the magazine. I had my Turkish bath, and then the terrible thoughts began to come back, and I was laying there in that cot in the little booth, and the light was shining down in my face. So I picked up the magazine just to read anything. And it was the Saturday Evening Post, and it was dated March 1st, 1941. And down at the bottom, in letters about an inch high, it said, Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander. March 1st issue, 1941. My God. And so I opened it, and with goose pimples coming out, because I had picked up a Time magazine with an article in it by Fulton Ousler 2 years before that, in 1939, when I was at my mother-in-law's home, a saintly lady, 2 years before, I had picked it up in Liberty Magazine, now defunct, of course. But there was a short article in there that said, The Alcoholics and God. And I had read that, and he had written his first piece about Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was very short. And he simply said there was a small band of men who were meeting regularly and banding together who were alcoholics who did not want to drink. And so they met weekly and discussed their experiences, and they called themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, I'll go back there. I'll find them. I will do that. And I couldn't wait to get out. I just couldn't wait. I looked at the pictures, you see, and I turned, it was a full-page photo. And there were two men, and they were sitting by a bed. And I thought, oh, they're in a hospital. That man's awfully sick. He's probably as sick as I am. And there were these men there, and I thought, mentally, see, I didn't read the article, just looked at the pictures, because I knew about AA, having seen it in Liberty. And so I thought, he's awfully sick, and they're there in the AA hospital where they cure him. Just as real as if it would work, you know. And I turned the, it had AA hospital on it, you know. That, they'd wheel him off to that. And then I turned the page, and there they were talking to him in the bed there, and I thought, oh, that's where they cure them, you know, and I was gonna, and then I turned to the end of the article to see where to find them, and I thought, I'll take the next plane back there, and so I got the box number, I don't know what it was then, but we'll say box 1345 or whatever, Grand Central Station, New York, and I wrote a letter to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I'm a woman alcoholic, and I'm at the point of death from drinking, and I can do no better, and I have a lovely home and good family, and I have a little girl, and I can't make it at all. I cannot make it at all. What can I do? I must enter your AA hospital and get cured. Please tell me where you are, and I will be there as soon as possible. And I gave them my address and phone number and everything, and I went on home and got my foot in the door one more time, and I waited for an answer, and it came right away, air mail, and it was from Ruth Hawk. God bless her. She was Bill Wilson's secretary then, a little 25-year-old girl who worked for Bill free because he had no money. He gave her stock in Alcoholics Anonymous is what he did. That's what they did. They laughed about it later, but that's really what happened. And so my answer came, and she said, I'll never forget her handwriting. I'll never forget her signature, rather. Ruth Hawk. I can see it now. And the letter was not too long, but it simply said, Dear Sybil, we were glad to hear from you here at the New York office. And you need not come back here to find Alcoholics Anonymous, because in December 19, 1939, they started Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles, your own hometown. And we will say this, there are very few of them. I started with two men, and one man actually finding another, and then they joined together. But we understand now that they're meeting in the Elks Temple in Los Angeles and no longer meeting in homes in Pasadena. So I will give you the telephone number and address of the man who appears to be, leading the group, or he has started the group or helped with it in some way, because he's the only one we correspond with at this time. And so she gave me Frank Randall's address at 532 South Coronado and his phone number. And so I went ahead and got drunk first. And because she had, unfortunately for me, had added a P.S. at the bottom of the letter. If you need help immediately, call Cliff Walker at Crestview 12345, whatever it was. Cliff Walker. And the name, I will get tears if I even talk about him, because he really saved my life. I got drunk in this bar and I got thrown out. And then I remembered AA, and I got out the phone number of Cliff, which was Crestview something or other then, and called him up, and his sleepy voice answered, and I said, Send your AA ambulance and pick me up. I'm ready. And he said, that's not it. Well, we don't do that. What kind of an outfit are you anyway? I got drunk, and you should have called me before you got drunk. I said, we have a meeting downtown. I don't go because I'm a milkman, and I'm ready to leave the house now and settle for milk. You should have gone to the meeting Friday night. The meeting's been over for hours. Why didn't you go? And I said, I did, but they threw me out. Oh, he said, that's impossible. That's impossible. They wouldn't have done that. They would have been so happy to have you. He said, we've never had a woman alcoholic. We've never had a woman alcoholic. We understand that there is one in New York who is... they don't know how it will work out with her, but her name is Marty Mann. But we've never had a woman alcoholic. There has never been except that one back there that we don't know what her record is. So, actually, I couldn't do it anyway, but I'll give you Frank Randall's phone number. And I said, yeah, but they did throw me out. And he said, there's been some mistake. They thought you were a wife. There was no Al-Anon. And any wife who came with her husband brought her knitting or something, I guess. And Frank would make this announcement. I'm jumping ahead to tell you what he would say. He'd say, this is the regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in California. We're a bunch of ex-drunks who've gathered together to obtain and maintain our sobriety on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. And I would sit there shivering and shaking and say, what an order. I can't go through with this. Who could? I mean, all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. But that's what happened. He said, go down there and tell him that I'm going to get in touch with him and tell him that there was an unfortunate mistake today, that we now have a woman alcoholic on the West Coast as well as Marty Mann on the East Coast. And so the following Friday, I did go down, and I was really shaking and nervous. And I don't know why I had the nerve to do it after what I thought had happened to me, but he tried to make me... feel comfortable. And so when I went back, I had this red turban on and bloodshot eyes, and my face was just a mess. I know. If the dresses were long then, I wore them short. If they were short, I wore them long. I was always behind and everything. And so I sat there just palpitating and scared witless. Frank was, he was so eloquent. He was talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and his story about getting drunk in Phoenix, Arizona and everything. And then when it came to this point about, and now then, before we get into talking to you alcoholics so that you can talk, we're going to ask the women leave the room. He said, except if there are any here who will call themselves alcoholics, those women may remain. And he looked right at me. So I grinned and I folded my arms and I stayed, and the wives got up and left, and they had their own special type of little island I'm leading out there, I guess. And I stayed, and so I remained, and from that day to this. And as I say, it's been glorious, it's been wonderful, and then I've had my share of problems and illnesses in the family and all of those things that happen to everybody all over the world, whether they ever had a drink or not. It's